Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. You are listening to the Empowerment Hour. I absolutely promise that you're going to learn insights into every aspect of health, healing, social issues that allow you a broader range of options. Today, the latest on how to improve your blood vessel health, how weight training can reduce the risk of diabetes. Also, we're going to look at children's healthy diets lead to a healthier IQ, and growing up grateful gives teens multiple mental health benefits. Also, from our commentary from John Scales Avery from Countercurrents, the adverse effects of globalization, which we are adamantly opposed to globalization. An in-depth report, very important you listen to this and share this with other people, from Sayer Jai, founder of Green Med Info, a very good consumer medical information source. I read an article flying back from California on Sunday morning about chemotherapy and radiation and how they actually make cancers more malignant. Now, since I just finished a brand new book on cancer, just turned it in last week, I had this information in there. The public won't see this for about 4 or 5 months till the book's published, so I'll share what he has to say because it aligns with my own research on why there's a massive amount of malpractice when people are told, oh, we got to give you chemotherapy and radiation, even if we got the cancer out through surgery. No, you don't. And they have no science on their side to support what they're doing. They're experimenting on you. From Harvey Wasserman, a man that we have a lot of respect for because he's done so much for so long, he had written an article entitled Death Dancing with Atomic Energy, Fukushima Hangs by the Devil's Thread, from Counterpunch. I'll share that with you. Time permitting, from Ron Paul, U.S. Moving Towards War in Syria, it's a short piece, and 7 climate change diseases that are here now because of climate change. I won't have time today, but I will be getting to it this week, an in-depth report from Midwifery Today, from Carolyn Rogers, on prenatal ultrasound. Now, as we know, when parents want to know the gender of their developing fetus, they get an ultrasound, and they see if they've got one child or twins, and what the sex is, and it's supposed to give them an idea if it's healthy or not. Well, brand new information that's going to show you it's one of the most dangerous things you can possibly do. It increases the risk of autism. Now, how it creates an increased risk in autism and other birth defects, that's in the report that I'll be doing, and it's a long report. Won't have time today, but I will get to it this week. So those are just some of the issues. No guest today because we wanted to diminish the number of guests to give you more time to share your thoughts and questions and comments on our talkback segment of our program, which will come in about 25 minutes. Let's begin. Vitamin E comes in 8 different fractions. There's what's called the tocopherols, like gamma and beta and delta, and the tocotrienols. And it's best to take them as a mixture, and between 400 to 1,000 units a day. And if you have diabetes, if you have gangrene, if you have congestive heart failure, if you have high blood pressure, then that amount will change and you have to be guided by someone qualified in the field that can save lives. This is in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry. Here's what it says. Mixed vitamin E may support blood vessel health in healthy adults. Short-term supplementation with vitamin E may support the function of cells lining blood vessels from potential damage during increase in blood sugar levels after eating. 5 days of supplementation with gamma tocopherol-rich mixture of tocopherols maintain vascular endothelial function, the function of the cells lining blood vessels, according to these findings. Now, in lay language, what this means is this. This was done at the University of Connecticut and Changwon National University in South Korea. Visualize it as if you have a brand new water hose in your backyard. And initially, it's very pliable. You can bend it, and it's no problem. But let's say you leave it out in the sun. And after a summer of being left in the sun, it dries out and cracks. And then you can't bend it. That's like our arteries. And the cells lining our arteries are called epithelial cells. And having healthy epithelial cells means that nutrients from our blood and oxygen can go from the bloodstream into the cell and nourish the cell, whether it's the heart muscle or the lungs or brain or eyes, liver, kidneys, spleen, pancreas. That's how we actually get nutrients into the cells and toxic material and carbon dioxide out of the cells. When President Clinton was given his annual exam, I commented on the air that I don't know what standards they're using, but this is a man who smoked, who ate cheeseburgers, who did not exercise, who was overweight, drank alcohol, and was stressed, did not take supplements. So what were they looking for to give him a clean bill of health? Then 3 weeks later, he was rushed in for emergency triple bypass surgery. The good news is, and I commend him on this, he has taken to a vegan diet and hopefully stopped all these other unhealthy practices. And I've always said that it requires a policy maker or an opinion leader who makes positive changes then to act as a beacon for others. If you're not a policymaker or an opinion leader, you could be, you know, the guy at the factory that loses 100 pounds in a healthy way, learns to deal with stress more appropriately, and all the other workers around you will look at you like, what'd you lose weight for? Now, if you're a famous person and you do the same thing, people want to know what diet you're on. And if you're a policymaker, then there's a special reverence for that. We defer to policymakers in our society. We should not, because the assumption is that if you're a policymaker, you have a wisdom, not just merely knowledge, and you are a person who has our interests at stake. That may or may not be the case. Think of all the policymakers who had bad diets, were stressed out, and that's what people look at. So when he gave up all the pro-inflammatory foods and started eating living foods and healthier foods, it healed him substantially. Now, what they didn't look for, according to the articles I read, but they should, is the fact that President Clinton should know this. And I'm sure we have people in this audience. I know we have people in this audience who know him personally because some of these people are my friends. Pass this message on. They only look for the symptoms of the acute blockages, the acute pathology. They did not look in his brain. I'm willing to bet that former President Clinton has advanced brain damage because an inflammatory cytokine or tumor necrosis factor alpha and any one of dozens of other free radical elements, when they're in the blood, they go through the whole system every 6.5 minutes, and they pass the blood-brain barrier. That means that if you had occlusion in your arteries, you're going to have amyloid cells in your brain. That means you're going to end up with dementia and Alzheimer's much faster. So pass on this information, if you would, please. There are protocols for reversing brain aging. There are protocols that can help reverse memory loss and make a person far more cognitive. So even though I'm against virtually all of his political stands, and I am absolutely for everyone when it comes to their health, I hold no animus and wish everyone to live a long and healthy life. So pass it on. He may be able to get that information and may realize that what was done to help save his life nutritionally could also be done to save his brain. Otherwise, I predict that within the next 5 years, you'll see a substantially different cognitive condition in him. And I've seen it too many times. Even last night, in between my work, I ran up to get a juice and a soup, and a person came over and with their close friend and said, Gary, I was just told that there's going to be some solar flares and that could cause, if it goes bad, an outage of electricity. Is that true? Can you tell me about that? So I spent about 15 minutes explaining what could happen. The solar flares are coming in about 9 to 14 months. That's no controversy on that. It's coming. How bad it will be is what's still not known. But if history is an indicator, it could be 15x or worse. At 15, we will lose power, not necessarily forever, but we'll lose power. A substantial part of the Northeast and Midwest will. How long that power is out is going to be the deciding factor, and whether or not they will put surge protectors in place. The deciding factor is if it's 20x, then the power is not coming back on. The nuclear power plants will have anywhere from 1 week to 4 weeks maximum backup fuel to run their generators so they can bring in about 2 to 3 billion gallons of water a day to cool their reactors and their spent fuel rods. When that runs out, you're going to have Fukushima's. Around Chicago, that has the most nuclear power plants, and New York City. So the guy looks at me and he says, what's this mean? I said, well, it means this. First to die and be poisoned and will not be able to be helped will be the children. You'll see blood running from their eyes, their nose, their mouth, and their ears. The older people will die quickly if there's a Fukushima, because no one will know there's a Fukushima. There won't be any alarms, no sirens. There's no exit plan. There won't be gasoline. And if you dig it on the road, you're going to meet nothing but a bumper-to-bumper traffic, because everyone's going to be backed up and there's no place to get gas. In the city, you can't hide from radiation. Radiation will permeate any building. If you have a radiation suit, that'll give you some protection, but you're breathing it, and that means you're going to still be exposed. So then it's a slower contamination. But based upon the fact we're only 28 miles from the actual cores, that means that 20 million Americans will suffer serious radiation toxicity, and I'm going to guess half will die within the next 9 to 12 months, and New York City would be contaminated forever. Forever. The richest and the poorest will all be affected. And the interesting part is the richest will, for the first time probably in their life, have to fend for themselves, because no one's going to be there to attend to their needs. The police won't be there. No one's going to be there. So I said, I don't want to know about this. He said, I'd rather just have it happen. He said, because I'm not into planning for this kind of stuff. And he left. Here's the interesting part. I'd had that same conversation 12 times with the same person over the last year. 12 times. He had forgotten the other 11, and I'm sure by today he forgot that conversation. And he has dementia. He's unaware of it. When you don't remember what you've forgotten, then you're unaware that you have forgotten. And that's the sad part of dementia, because on all other levels, a person can seem to function fine and look fine. They're not. So my major goal in the next 14 to 16 months is helping people understand how we age, how our brain ages, how we end up losing our memory and suffer from dementia, and how we can reverse that. Next up. Weight training is linked to reduced risk of type 2 diabetes. This is from Science Daily, published in Archives of Internal Medicine. Here's what it says. Men who do weight training regularly, I suggest 30 minutes a day minimum, 5 days a week, can reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 34%. That's according to Harvard School of Public Health and University of Southern Denmark. I would go one step further. If you were to get rid of the high glycemic or high sugar foods in your diet, and if you were to exercise aerobically every day, you could reduce your risk by about 100%. There's absolutely no reason for anyone to have adult type 2 diabetes today in the United States. There's no reason. But this is showing just weight training is one way of preventing it, and that's good. From the University of Adelaide in Australia, children fed a healthy diet in early life have a higher IQ, while those who have a heavier junk food diet have a reduced IQ. Once again, and this was children in this study were, there were 7,000 of them. So for all the parents, I realize the hassle when children are influenced by their peers and want something, and with so many parents today working to get the love and respect of their children instead of being a model of health themselves and setting some boundaries without fearing using the word discipline, but actually engaging in discipline. The temper tantrums you're going to be exposed to now will remain but a moment. A healthy child is forever. Giving in and letting your child gorge and binge on all these junk foods that all the other kids are eating and the parents are allowing, now you're going to end up with a child that does not have the same mental capacity and has a high probability of dying before you. That's the second study. Children born today in the United States frequently will not outlive their parents. That is a disgrace. Shame on the Surgeon General. Shame on the President of the United States. Shame on everybody who's in any public or official position in the media. These are all people who know the truth or could find the truth, but no one today in official positions dares threaten their economic advertisers or future jobs or political campaigns by taking on the junk food industry and the hamburger industry and the fast food chains, and they should be taken on. I believe they should be held crimes against humanity because they've caused more death and destruction than any war in American history. These are murderers. When you feed a kid who is innocent junk food and you give him diabetes and then they get heart disease and you're shortening their life, who should be held accountable? Or should we just say, well, in a free market, you let anyone, you know, the market will correct itself. No, it won't. No, it won't. There's no angel dust on this issue. It's cut and dried. There's no equal and fair time. You're killing people. You're cynical, you're selfish, you're insecure, and you're big corporate interest. And you bought the politicians, you bought the talking head idiots on radio and television that are an embarrassment to listen to and watch. Thank goodness there are an awful lot of progressive minds, both conservative and liberal, and let us remember that. For the elitists and arrogance on the left, there are a whole lot of people you could be aligning with if you just put down your ego and your ideology for a moment to join you in making it a better world. Oh, I forgot, self-righteousness doesn't include everyone, does it? Well, in my world, we're all included. And that's why I guess the biggest movement in America today is progressive independent movement. We represent 50% of the total population who are voters in America. We will, in time, if given the opportunity to have any influence, we won't allow these ads on television. There should be a black box warning and at least a public education program over our entire American diet. Because it's killing us, and I mean a lot of us. And finally, growing up grateful gives teens multiple mental health benefits. This is from Science Daily, done at the California State University. Here's what it says. Grateful teens, there are three of them that I counted in the United States, are more likely than less grateful teens. That's, gee whiz, are there any other, to be happy. Oh, you mean we're allowing teens to be happy now? Give me the credit card. Talk to me over Twitter. Don't look me in the eyes. Don't bother me. Stay out of my room. It's my cave. All right. Dear. less likely to abuse drugs and alcohol. Oh, you mean that's a bad thing for teens to abuse drugs, alcohol, the English language, the intellect, the brain, ethics, philosophy, decency? Yeah, and less likely to have behavioral problems. Oh, you mean the young people have behavioral problems today? Yeah, there are four of them that don't, according to research from the American Psychological Association. Quote, gratitude played an important role in many areas of positive mental health of the teens in our study. Increases in gratitude over a four-year period were significantly related to improvements in life satisfaction, happiness, positive attitudes, and hope. When comparing the results of the least grateful 20% of the students with the most grateful, they found that teens with the most gratitude by the end of the four-year period gained 15% more of a sense of meaning in their life, 15% more satisfied with their life overall at home, at school, and with their neighborhood, with their friends and themselves, 17% more happy and more hopeful about their lives, and 13%, and those who experienced negative emotions, they had a substantial increase in depression and negative thoughts. Just one member of our audience who emails me occasionally, though I'm backed up on my emails, I managed to see this, said two of her employees, young people, have committed suicide in the last month, and her son, who owns a restaurant, a 20-year-old, committed suicide there. Why are so many teens committing suicide instead of getting some form of help? What is the underlying cause? Well, first, most of these were on antidepressant medication, and it's not a side effect. Let's get out of this idea that these are side effects. These are the effects, or suicide or homicidal rages. 98% of all mass murders committed in the United States in the last 20 years have been people on these meds. Will we be honest and look at this? No, we will not. We'll blame the guns by themselves instead of looking at how we alter a person's brain chemistry artificially, and then what happens to a person's perception when you alter it, how they can go postal, they go ballistic. And then we don't look for the underlying cause. Why? Because there's an enormous amount of money. There are think tanks, there's doctors and scientists who immediately, when there's a crisis, run in and re-divert our energy away from the real cause. I believe that we should do something immediately. I believe that in every school in America, a mandatory curriculum should be coping with life. We should have real, not institutional counselors, but real life sociologists, behavioralists, psychotherapists in every school, in every community, in every suburban and urban area where anyone who has a problem coping can have someone who is neutral to them, not a family member, who may be the problem or part of the problem or unsympathetic to their needs, who they can sit and talk with. So at least they have some support system. It is frequently when a person feels that there is no support system and they feel that there is gross disparity and there is nothing going to get better for them, and if their character values have not been properly and thoroughly developed, then there's a high probability that they will feel so hopeless that they will resign themselves that not living is better than living. And then they'll kill themselves. Now, put on top of that the amount of drugs and alcohol that people are taking. Put on top of that, many people have no idea who they are. You cannot blame the young people for that. You have to look at the environment they grew up in, the epigenetics. And until the age of about 10, there is no real intellectual understanding of what otherwise would look like a very existential mixture of energies coming in, and they absorb them all. When you're 5 years old and someone screams at you, when you're 4 years old and someone demeans you, when you're 12 years old and someone ridicules you, you take it very personally. But you can't intellectualize it, and you have no defenses. You can't walk out of the house. So you emotionalize it, and that becomes the tapes. And those tapes play over and over and over again, and then they're reinforced by anything that you find in life, even if it's not an accurate match that comes close to it, a word, a statement, a gesture. And then that becomes your story. And then one day, there's the tipping point where something happens, maybe something relatively insignificant, but something that you identify as you did when you were a kid, and you just feel overwhelmed by it, and you give up. When I was growing up, when many of you were growing up, no one committed suicide. No one. Today, it's every day. That's why I'm building this Veterans Village to help all our returning golf veterans who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental conditions, getting them the best holistic clinical psychological work. I'm getting a holistic psychiatrist, holistic psychologist, behavioralist, sociologist, all that I'm going to put there to help these people in a very humanistic environment. I'm going to start with a small model, 30, and follow them for a year and see if we can't help turn their lives around so they have a meaningful, balanced life and redevelop a sense of the beauty of life and get away from the trauma of war and its conflict and all the things they saw or witnessed or participated in. And so they can regain a place in society and with their families. You would have thought that somewhere, someone would have done this. They haven't. And I've been everywhere, everywhere. I've spoken with thousands of vets, and they're just left out to dry. That's unfortunate. But hopefully, with a year from now, we will have a model to change it. I also believe, and for those down in Camden, New Jersey, I've asked many times, but I get no response from the mayor's office or anyone in Camden. I'm willing to rehabilitate an entire neighborhood on my own dime, not asking a penny from anyone, not asking for any help from anyone. I can do it myself. But I can't go in there unless I get permission and am given a block. And what I'm asking you is give me the worst block in Camden, New Jersey. The worst. Now, I've been all over Camden. I've been everywhere in Camden. I've been on every block in Camden when I was filming my documentary earlier this year on several occasions. So I'm very familiar with it. You choose the block that is absolutely non-redeemable, where there's abject, complete poverty, gangs, drugs, violence. That's the block I want. And if I can turn that block around, if I can get the people there the help they need, if I can get the teenagers to help and the seniors to help, if I can get them to rehabilitate with me their own neighborhood, to take pride back in rebuilding a neighborhood, then it shows it can be done everywhere. And all it takes is one example of something that changes our perception to change our reality. So once again, I'll reach out to the officials in, all four of them, in the poorest city in America, and per population, the most crime-ridden city in America. There's over 200 open-air drug markets in Camden. There's help that can be provided at no cost to you, and let me put it to the test. All right? So you got to get back to me. I got to have a letter. Got to show that, you know, tell me what you're going to give me to work with, and I'll do everything else. All right? Now, let's go to our next issue. I'm against globalization. You've heard the reasons why on many programs, documentaries, my latest documentary. Oh, I forgot to mention my latest documentary. First, I want to thank all of the doctors or their family members who came to the lecture in San Francisco on Friday. The thousands of you who were there, I'm sorry that there weren't enough seats. No one planned on having 500 people have to stand. I had nothing to do with that, but I appreciate the fact that you were all patient and stood. And I'm also appreciative that many people allowed new ideas in. Good for you. For all the people who came to the two different showings in L.A. on Saturday, to the volunteers who helped, I thank you all for that. I was asked yesterday, would I have a showing in Manhattan where I generally show, I've shown five films for free, down at the Theater for the New City, and my schedule is so packed, I said, okay, I'll do that, but the only time I can be there and show the film, and this will be the last showing in New York, will be this Saturday. This Saturday, there will be a showing. It won't be, they asked down there, could I ask the people to give them a small amount of money, $5 each, just to cover the cost, because otherwise they're losing money on every one of the times we show down there. And I think that's very reasonable. I'm donating my time, I'm donating the film, and they're really donating almost everything to us. If you want to join me, this Saturday, 7:30, at First Avenue and 9th Street, at the Theater for the New City, to see The War on Health, the FDA's Call of Tyranny. Call this number. Now, it's always been packed and standing room only, so you got to call. Don't just show up. 212-254-1109. 212-254-1109 for reservations. And it's always been free in the past, but it's really not fair to them because they have to pay for the projectionist and their staff to stay there because it always runs late because they do Q&A afterwards. And maybe we'll go out afterwards. There's a place in the neighborhood there. I think Angelica can have a little late bite to eat and to continue our conversation. We're on Health, Saturday, one showing only. I'm finished with all the showings on this. It's gone viral over the internet, so it's your chance to be there in person, see it, and have a Q&A. We're on Health, Saturday, 7:30, 9th Street and 1st Avenue, 212-250-1109. And they called and asked, would I do it? And I said, fine. Now, I'm opposed to globalization. First, because the whole point of globalization is to take a product that historically had been made in the United States, and hopefully, and certainly with most of the cases from the 1940s through the 1970s, was made at a living wage, where 50% of the labor was union labor, and there were rights and benefits to that, and I support that. And then you made something USA, and you bought something that was made in USA. Globalization is taking that same item and offshoring it to another country that can be made exploitative labor in that country and then brought back and sold in the Walmart. Hence, I am boycotting Walmart. I'm boycotting corporations. And this is how you do it. It's this simple. You become your own grassroots movement. You simply refuse to go into any of the major corporate stores. You refuse to buy any product that was made at slave labor or exploitative labor. You refuse to buy something that was grown or harvested or shipped where a fair trade was not engaged. That's your capacity. You can do that. And if you do it, enough of us are doing it and support locally grown, locally made, locally produced goods and services, foods, then we take back the power. And hence, we challenge globalization. But we have to have enough people willing to do it. This is from John Scales Avery from Counter Currents. I'll quote this. It's short. Today, economic globalization aims at increased trade throughout the world. At first sight, this might seem to be a benefit. However, laws preventing the exploitation of labor are not universal. The same unspeakable conditions experienced by workers in factories and mines during the early phases of the Industrial Revolution in Europe can be found today among factory workers in Indonesia or children weaving oriental carpets in Pakistan. It is estimated that in India alone, there are 80 million exploited child laborers. In many developing countries today, industrialization involves slave-like working conditions. Meanwhile, in the industrialized countries, workers may lose their jobs because they cannot compete with underpaid labor in the third world. Large multinational corporations are tending to move their operations to regions where salaries and living standards are very, very low. For free trade to be truly beneficial to all the people of the world, universal laws must be established to regulate business and industry globally and to ensure that multinationals act in a way that is both socially and ecologically responsible. Adam Smith's followers advocated complete freedom from government restraint. But the history of the Industrial Revolution demonstrates the need for regulatory social legislation. The historical perspective makes it clear that laws establishing minimum wage levels and laws prohibiting child labor are needed to avoid horrors such as those described by John Feldman in The Curse of the Factory System. Today, birth control is also necessary on a global scale, such as it once was needed in England to raise workers above the starvation level. Finally, unions must be permitted everywhere in the world. If trade is globalized, the hard-won reforms achieved by Charles Knowlton and Annie Besant and the Fabians and others must be also globalized. In conclusion, We can also consider the non-discrimination principle adopted by GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades. This principle states that participating countries, quote, cannot discriminate between like products on the basis of the method of production, end quote. This single principle allows multinational commerce to escape from all the humanitarian and environmental reforms that have been achieved since the start of the Industrial Revolution. No matter if the method of production involves destruction of a tropical rainforest, no matter if forced labor was used, we are not allowed to discriminate, quote, on the basis of the method of production. And we can thank Bill Clinton and his administration for putting that language together. I'm Gary Knoll. That's up to this point. Now we're going to go to TalkBack. Your opportunity to call in and share your points of view. We're happy to hear you. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. By the way, yesterday when I was interviewing Gerald Celante near the end of the show, a lot of people moved over from the land-based terrestrial station to the telephone to listen, and a lot were not able to get on. As I would find out today, we had more people switch to the telephone yesterday than ever at one time. So we've informed the provider, can you expand the service? And they were surprised because they have this service all over the world in 40 countries, 500 corporations, and we're number one using it. Tens and tens of thousands of people, one unique people, not cumulatively, just individuals, are listening at this on this service over the phone. 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. Oh, by the way, before you take your call here in a moment, which we will, last Saturday afternoon in Washington, D.C., an aide to Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi had visited the bishop of the Catholic Cathedral in D.C. He told the cardinal that Nancy Pelosi would be attending the next day's Mass, and he asked if the cardinal would kindly point out Pelosi to the congregation and say a few words that would include calling Pelosi a saint. The cardinal replied, "No, I don't really like the woman, and there are issues of conflict with the Catholic Church over certain of Pelosi's views." Pelosi's aide then said, "Well, look, I'll write a check, and right here and now, for $10,000 to your church, if you'll just tell the congregation you see Pelosi as a saint." The cardinal thought about it and said, "Well, the church can use the money, so I'll work the request into tomorrow's sermon." As Pelosi's aide promised, Pelosi appeared on that day, the Sunday worship, and seated herself prominently at the forward left side of the center aisle. As promised, at the start of the sermon, the cardinal pointed out that Pelosi was present. The cardinal went on to explain to the congregation, quote, "While Congresswoman Pelosi's presence is probably an honor to some, the woman is not numbered among my personal favorite personages. Some of her views are contrary to the tenets of the church, and she tends to flip-flop on many other issues. Nancy Pelosi is a petty, self-absorbed hypocrite, a thumbsucker, and a nitwit. Nancy Pelosi also is a serial liar, a cheat, and a thief. I must say Nancy Pelosi is the worst example of a Catholic I have ever personally witnessed. She married for money and is using her wealth to manipulate the American people. She also has a reputation for shirking her representative obligations both in Washington and California. The woman simply is not to be trusted," the cardinal concluded. "But compared with President Obama, Pelosi is a saint." Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm going to spend the rest of the hour taking your calls, but I did want to get this short piece by Ron Paul in. As many of you know, I had Ron Paul on the air, and we debated several issues that we share in opposite points of view, but on many points of view, Ron Paul and I are in complete alignment, and I welcome his support on those views, including the demilitarization of our world, especially from the United States imperial overreach, and shutting down the Federal Reserve and some other issues, and freedom of choice. Here's his latest. This is short. Quote, last week the House passed yet another bill placing sanctions on Iran and Syria, bringing up closer to another war in the Middle East. We are told that ever harsher sanctions finally will force the targeted nations to bend to our will. Yet the ineffectiveness of previous sanctions teaches us nothing. In truth, sanctions lead to war more often than they prevent war. Until last year, Libyan sanctions were touted as a great success story. The regime would change its behavior, yet NATO bombed the country anyway. Last week, we learned that President Obama signed an intelligence finding directing the CIA to covertly assist rebels in Syria. The administration seems determined to fight yet another war in Syria that has nothing to do with the American national interest. We already know that a similar finding was signed under the latest Bush administration directing U.S. intelligence to undermine the Iranian government and promote regime change there. Neoconservatives have long demanded that we overthrow the Syrian government before moving on to war against Iran. This bellicosity continues regardless of which party is in the White House. In Syria, we see how our interventionist policies backfire and make us less secure. Recent news reports point to ties between the Syrian opposition and Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups. A recent article in The Guardian, the British newspaper, exclaimed, quote, Al-Qaeda turns tide for rebels in battle of eastern Syria, end quote. The article quotes an Al-Qaeda leader in Syria saying that he meets with the main U.S.-backed Syrian rebel organizations, the Free Syrian Army, quote, almost every day. So by promoting civil war in Syria, we fuel Al-Qaeda. According to another recent press report, German intelligence services estimated that nearly 100 terrorist attacks have been committed by Al-Qaeda or related organizations in Syria over the past 6 months. Last month, a suicide bomber in Syria killed a defense minister and several top government officials. The U.S. government, which had been fighting, quote, the war on terror, end quote, for more than a decade, now refused to condemn that act of terrorism. This raises the question of whether the United States administration is supporting the same people in Syria that we had been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton expressed these same concerns earlier this year when she asked whether the U.S. had been reluctant to arm the Syrian rebels. She answered, quote, to whom are you delivering them? We know Al-Qaeda is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? End quote. In conclusion, this is a very good question. It clearly demonstrates the United States has no business at all being involved in the Syrian civil war. In the 1980s, we supported the resistance movement in Afghanistan that later gave birth to the elements of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. When will we learn our lesson and stop intervening in conflicts we don't truly understand, conflicts that have nothing to do with the American national interest? And just to put a fine point on that, on my Monday evening Progressive Commentary Hour, I did a 2.5-hour program with some of the leading scholars from the Middle East who were there in the Middle East talking about the real reasons that we were in Syria with boots on the ground and intelligence all over this, because we were working with Israel and their Mossad to regime change with the intent of creating internal conflict. Why? Because as long as we repeat what we did in Libya, which was perfect, then there are 900 different tribal organizations and leaders all in conflict. That makes it easy for multinational corporations to go in and do deals on buying the oil or anything else they want. The same would be true in Syria. Syria doesn't have oil, has other resources, but more importantly, as they all said, all my panelists, the road to Iran goes through Damascus in Syria, and from Iran you go to Russia. So there's a larger scheme here to involve us in a global conflict, and without question, when Iran is finally attacked, we will create a new major World War III in the Middle East, and it will impact Americans in a devastating manner. You're likely to see $15 to $25 for a gallon of gasoline, and the price of food will triple. And yet, all we have are people in the media, including and ashamedly on this station, banging the drums for intervention and not looking objectively. And as one of my friends told me yesterday, well, I'm sure that, you know, one of these popular people are well-intentioned. I said, you think so? I don't. I know where they get their funding. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's go to you and your turn. Let's say hello to Paul from Staten Island. Hi, Paul. Your turn.
The seeking of consistency in ideology and fairness. I know we know the genocide, the apartheid in South Africa is dreadful, but I noticed that, and it came to my attention that there's actually a reversal where targeting white farmers and the president is actually singing the song, you know, shoot the white farmer, and at the centennial celebration.
Okay, and, first, it's not South Africa, it is Zimbabwe, where there was confiscation of the farms, the larger farms, and before that had been Rhodesia. And in the process of building up an export economy, meaning growing more food than what could be consumed, and hence it was 100% food efficient, it began to export food to other countries in Africa and around the world that required it. And then under the current regime, there was the limitation of being able to farm in South Africa and the breaking up the farm. It was how it was done that was appalling, and without the process of real law. And there was reverse discrimination. The trouble is there was no mediation that had the power of the president or his ruling party, where it would have been far wiser, in my opinion, to have set aside state land that the federal government controlled, and then brought in coalitions of agriculturalists and agronomists and people who have deep experience and knowledge in how to grow crops, which crops to grow in the very rich soils, and how to do it efficiently, and then to take a certain percentage of the profits from your largest and most efficient and well-run farms, and that is set aside in compensation for those people whose lands were originally expropriated by them, and then to educate the new farmers, and then have the government provide these people with farms and then the tools necessary to do the farming. So, A, you would have allowed for subsistence farming, and then for local farming, then the larger they got and the better they were, they could then exploit that, the natives in any given country, not just in Zimbabwe, any place in the world, to larger markets. So you didn't have to tear down one system in order to create another one, because what happened is in those farms that were taken down, because there was no education, there was no tutorial, there was no apprenticing, frequently they just went to seed and therefore helped no one, and hence you had mass starvation where the people of Zimbabwe were relegated. Unless you were in the power elite, you were relegated to eating rats. In fact, one of the largest businesses was going into the fields, catching rats, and then selling them. It was the methods used, and it wasn't by everyone. Thank you for your call. Let's say hello to George from Connecticut. Hi, George. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. I'm wondering how I can get the excerpts of the best parts of what you were talking about, that bill, because it'd be great to send on to friends, family, and also every representative and congressman. They can't say that they don't know what's in that bill or was stuck there and they never saw that portion. And also maybe to people like Amnesty International, et cetera, organizations like that, so that they can all become aware of this, so that it becomes a very hot potato for these people to pass that. And one other thing I wanted to ask is a possibility, since we're doing all these illegal operations that are treasonable, why can't we on a state level find a way, maybe you can talk to some of your friends, you can find a way on a state level to impeach the president and deny him the police.
I'm not able to hear what you're saying. I'm sorry. I didn't hear the second part, but I did hear the first part. With all the articles that I address on this air and with all the issues, we post definitive information on my website by categories. So if you want to know and how to educate the public on a particular bill or a piece of legislation and which organizations you could get more information from or align for calls to action, we have all that per topic. So if it's on vaccines or closing down Indian Point or anti-fracking, we have all that information. Just go to the website, Okay, it's all there. Let's say hello to Richard from Rockland. Hi, Richard.
I'd like to talk a bit about globalization and a thing called worldwide auto parts. And I came about this because I had testified in front of State Senator John Sampson's hearings on judicial corruption. That led me into a guy that's making a huge video project called Lawless America, filming in hundreds of cities around the United States victims of the court system. In listening to this gentleman, whose name is Bill Windsor, and I would urge everybody to take a look at lawlessamerica.com, he had a guy on one night talking about worldwide auto parts. And worldwide auto parts manufactures auto parts in the United States, ships the products to Mexico where they're reboxed, sent back to America where they're in competition with legitimate American auto part makers who are paying their people living wages. But it turns out that worldwide auto parts is not really paying their people a legitimate wage.
Prison labor.
Excuse me?
Prison labor.
It's exactly right. But do you know who owns worldwide auto parts or who is the main investor?
No.
Judges. They are the ones who are sending the labor force to jail to make 25 cents an hour. They're reboxed in Mexico as if they are American products, or at least products made by people being paid somewhat of an illegitimate wage.
I understand what you're saying. 3 weeks from Monday on our Progressive Commentary Hour, it's Monday evenings at 7, I am doing a full 2 hours on the industrial prison system in the United States, including the judges who put people in jail and who are then exploited in jail, and how that is on a level similar to Haiti. We are covering that topic in depth. I thank you very much for bringing that to our attention, Richard. Let us say hello to, who do we have? We have, I'm not sure, Alfonso from Long Island. Let me mention, Alfonso, we're coming up near the end of this part of our program. We'll have an additional 5 minutes, and people want to listen over the internet, they can, or if they want to call that phone number, 832-280-0066, they can listen. Also, just want to mention again, this Saturday, 7:30, my last showing in New York of War on Health, the FDA's Call of Tyranny. This is this major film that's gone viral all over the world. I'll be there. We'll have a Q&A afterwards. And those who want to go out for a bite to eat on your own dime, happy to share the conversation in the neighborhood. I think 2 blocks away there's a place. You got to call for reservations. It's 212-254-1109. 212-254-1109. Historically, the 5 showings I've done there have been for free. However, they ask, could they at least get something from the audience to come in, like $5, to pay for their projectionist and their security person? I said, sure. I mean, $5 is $5. It's not a big deal. So call 212-254-1109 if you want to join me Saturday evening for the last showing in the area of the War on Health, the FDA's Call of Tyranny. Over to you. You're on, Alfonso.
Hi, Gary. I called last week about some holistic information, but I have a statement and I have a question. My statement is, I don't know if you've had time to see or look at pictures from the Aurora shootings, but the person that they perpetrated and the one that they caught and the one that they show you in the picture before they actually caught him are two different people. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Several people have brought that to my attention. What I've done is this. I worked on trying to establish the true identity of Eugenie Smith versus Anastasia back in the 1970s when I was working on my important original work on whether the royal family actually escaped or not or were murdered at Ekaterinburg, which we were told. And there's a methodology that the FBI uses in facial identification, bone structure. I've sent that information, that picture, off, the two pictures, and asked them, is this the same person or is not? I have no idea. It doesn't look like it's the same, but it could be. I don't want to make a statement till after I get back that forensic information, and it is being done now. Thank you, Alfonso. I appreciate you sharing that with us. We're going to wrap up here today with Luann Panessi, who's on the line now. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here from a Peter who asked this. He says, two experts who predicted the crash of 2008 are predicting the same thing in the near future, 2013, somewhere between 2013 and 2015, which you alluded to back on your August 4th show. He says, what I don't understand is why would real estate crash as well, which you mentioned. He said, I thought that hard assets like silver, gold, and real estate would keep their value. And then he makes the mistake of saying, I don't want to take too much of your time. If you have a short answer, I'd appreciate it. I know you better than that.
All right. First, I would not now consider any real estate or any possession that is indebted as a hard asset. I would consider that an indebted asset. But gold and silver are legitimate assets because you have to pay for them before you get them, but never buy certificates ever under any condition. Only take full possession of the actual asset and get the gold. Don't get antique coins. That's all rip-off. Don't get, just get dimes, because more often than not, people are going to use dimes more than any other denomination. If it's required, and I believe it's going to double. That's my own belief. Now, here's what I see coming. I see the major cities are not going to be reversed, but you will have this unique phenomena. Remember, we don't have one economy. We have eight economies, and each person is affected in the choices they make by the assets they have available to them. So if you're a person that can only afford one meal a day, where are you likely to eat, and what kind of food you're going to eat? You're going to go to a fast food joint and buy for $2, to buy a triple burger. Now, that's going to cause disease, and that'll cause malnourishment, but that's what they're going to do. Whereas if you're a person that isn't limited, if you have an income, or maybe you have savings, or maybe a pension and Social Security, then you're about 50 million Americans in that category, and that's a lot of people. That's more people than live in either California or New York State in its entirety. So you can't say everyone's going to suffer, everyone won't suffer. What will happen is that those people who are on Social Security and those people who do have Medicare benefits and who have pensions, I see a likelihood of this municipalities defaulting on pension contracts, and I see probably between 100 to 400 municipalities in the United States going bankrupt and then renegotiating their contracts, which will reduce the existing pensions probably by 50% on their requirements or interest. I also see them reducing benefits of Social Security going forward, but not for people currently, and in like increasing the age of retirement to get or age of getting like 68 instead of 66. I also see that the inner cities will start to be war zones. I see the suburbs becoming the inner cities. It will be virtually indistinguishable whether you're living in downtown Detroit or you're living in suburban Detroit. And that had always been an enormous separation. Those who could afford went to the suburbs because you got your own house. You rarely rented a house. You bought a house, and you were able to raise your family. And as long as you had gainful employment and were making a living wage, you could maintain a standard of living. All that's changed, and that's not coming back. There are no jobs. The foundation of any economic development is quality jobs. Now, quality jobs means a job not packing, boxes in Walmart, not flipping hamburgers, not cleaning someone's car, as I recently found with my own car when I pulled into a filling station and it was being washed because I'd just finished this thousands of mile road trip. And the guy who was drying it, one of the five people drying it with the towels, he didn't give me the impression that that's what he does. And I asked him. And he's 41 years old, and he was an adjunct professor. And he was broke. And this is the only job he could get, and he made about $8 an hour doing it. And it was embarrassing for him, but he had no choice, because he said sometimes some of his former students got their car washed, and he didn't know how to handle that. That's what's happening. So those jobs are not coming back. Between the cheap labor coming in that's highly skilled, taking the place of seniority, and people who've put their time and effort and blood and sweat and tears into showing that they deserve the standard of living, quality of life they're getting, all that's being eradicated. For the young person getting out of college now And I would think long and hard before I go to college on any level, unless you have some guarantee of being employed and paying back your debt. There's other ways that you should spend the next 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years. I don't see the jobs there. I have seen more jobs being outsourced, more corporations outsourcing, more profit being kept offshore. It's now up to $28 trillion, and they're keeping off out of the United States, sitting on $2 trillion in working capital now. It means for the most people, 254 million Americans, there is no happy outcome, not in their lifetime. To the contrary, as cities are denied a tax base because there's not enough people making enough money to have a quality of life, to buy things for sales taxes, to buy. And who are the largest purchasers? Who are the one group in America that had more money and more time and more security than any other group? The baby boomers. But look at where they're at today. I just finished filming this for a new documentary coming out. I filmed it for the last 4 years. It's now finished. It's called Getting Old in America. They're the ones who had the largest number of children, or largest, I should say, wrong. They're the ones who had the largest number of people born in a given time after World War II, but now they own their home, or they've sold their home, and they're not buying a new home. So if you don't have new people to take their place, who's going to buy all these homes? And don't be fooled for a second. The home market right now is terrible, and it's going to get worse, because they're warehousing homes by the millions. So the senior citizen, the baby boomer, were the economic stability for the gross domestic product. The young people don't have the money to go and buy a home. It'd be suicidal to buy a home today. So there is no happy outcome, and we will hit a big downward decline in real estate. The only place where real estate will maintain its value or go up will be in those very exclusive enclaves where more people who do have resources want to live for their own security and quality of life, where you'd never know there's a problem in the world living on the Upper West Side, or living on Fifth Avenue, or Central Park South, or Soho, or Tribeca, or in about 300 cities and neighborhoods in those cities. But everywhere else, we're in for a big hurt. And that's in spite of what's being said. There are no jobs coming back that are meaningful. Hope that answers the question. Yes, I agree. Those gentlemen, if they said we're going into a deep depression in the next 3 years, they are absolutely correct. And that is without a war in Iran, which will exacerbate it. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I thank you all for taking your time to listen. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.